Welcome to the Sandwich Parenting Podcast. I am your host, Sherry Yuen Hunter. Here, we speak with amazing guests to make the world a better place by helping people heal from intergenerational trauma. Sandwich parents are in between the way we got parented and the way we now want to parent our children.
My guest today is Angela, and she's a licensed marriage and family therapist, empowerment coach, who's passionate about destigmatizing mental health in the Asian American community, as well as helping women of color reclaim and raise their voices to embody their empowered, authentic selves, which is really, you know, all that we need to be doing as human beings. And otherwise known as the sassy Asian therapist on social media, Angela witnessed her students as a high school teacher struggling with toxic stress, racial trauma caused by structural inequalities. She's been witnessing the rise of anti-Asian hate crimes during the pandemic, and she has started her practice to be a much needed resource for the Asian community. So please welcome my guest, Angela.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Angela. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So this is going to be a weird question because I noticed on your website, which I love, by the way, I love your website. I want to start further back. I ask people about their origin story, but mm-hmm. I noticed that you're Taiwanese and I was born in Taiwan, and there's a lot of trauma associated with being Taiwanese and being part of this culture and, you know, this legacy of being part of Taiwan. So I'm wondering if you can share with our listeners the various layers, you know, of trauma. And just to be transparent, I'm what you would call an out-of-province person, Weisenren. And I think that you are actually a Benseren in-province person. So I'm curious about your thoughts about this.
Yeah, this is really interesting because I was born in Taiwan and I moved to the States when I was 2 years old. So I'm considered 1.5 generation. And so a lot of growing up, I wasn't really immersed in my Taiwanese culture and never really understood why. And I guess there's like different, we'll go into these layers, but for me, one of them, uncovered as I like sort of deconstruct my own cultural identity is understanding the history of Taiwan.
Yes.
And the 228 massacre.
Yes.
And how, you know, yeah, let's take a deep breath there. I mean, just to start off on a heavy note, right?
I know. Sorry.
Let's just go all in.
Let's go.
But yeah, the 228 massacre was when the Chinese Nationalist Party came and really just senselessly murdered and killed thousands, 28,000 Taiwanese individuals, like without reason, just on the streets. And my great uncle was actually imprisoned for 40 years for just signing a petition. And so my dad, you know, when I was a kid, he always told me, like, never sign petitions, never like do any of that, like never speak up. If you have an opinion, like just swallow it. You don't need to make noise, kind of thing. And I was like, what the heck? Like, why? In me, like, it just felt like this world was so unsafe. So I never did speak up. And it's so interesting because like the Taiwanese people are like a minority within the minority, right? Because you have like the Asians, the umbrella Asians diaspora.
Yes.
And then like that in itself is a minority and invisible minority, if you will, right? Because of the model minority myth.
100%.
Being perpetual foreigners, you have these two stereotypes, but on the same side of like same coin, just different sides, right?
Yes.
And these stereotypes are just, they still keep people from being seen for who we really are, right? But then even just within this Asian diaspora is, you know, the Taiwanese community, and we're just so unseen. And the reason, and I'm starting to realize, you know, people say like Asians don't speak up, well, you know, the model minority myth, but then for Taiwanese people, we don't speak up because there's been so much political trauma. The second you speak up, you're killed, you're imprisoned, right? And so And then compound that with like cultural stuff, right? Especially with women, like women are not supposed to, you know, speak up, make noise. The nail that sticks up gets hammered down, like don't rock the boat, be seen, not heard, right? So this patriarchal double standard for women.
On top of being Asian, mm-hmm. right? So like, it's like this intersection of double that pressure.
Yeah. Double, absolutely. And then like within filial piety,
oh my God. Yeah.
Challenging or being seen as ungrateful. And then like compound that. There's just like so many compoundings. Like you come into America as immigrants, as children of immigrants, you're never wanting to be a burden to your parents because you've seen the struggle. So you want to like make yourself small so yeah. that you don't cause your parents more pain.
100%. And they had a lot of pain, like in so many different ways, mm-hmm. in so many different ways. Like a lot of them came through like the massacre, but before that, even like a lot of war, occupation,
mm-hmm. Like colonization.
Like there's so much of that in Taiwan yeah. that nobody ever talks about because we're like this tiny little island, you know?
Yeah. As a people been so colonized, right? Like that mm-hmm. colonial mindset is so embedded within us that we don't really know who we are as a people.
I agree.
Yeah. Right. But then like when you have that oppression, you also have the beauty of resistance. You know, I can't talk about oppression without talking about the strength of our people. Mm-hmm. And why it's such a big deal growing up hearing people say like, be proud to be Taiwanese, right? If people say like, you're Chinese, correct them, they like, no, I'm Taiwanese. I never understood why until I like understood the history of oppression. And it's to claim their identity from people who have been trying to hijack their identity. And that's so powerful.
100%. And my parents actually came from China. When they were like 4, right? So like they were really young. They were escaping the war, the communists, and mm-hmm. they escaped to Taiwan. And yeah. so I was told that I was Chinese,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's very confusing because I was born in Taiwan.
Yeah.
Okay. But I was told that I was Chinese and not Taiwanese. And so it's been very confusing as an identity for me. Like you, my parents, we then immigrated to the US when I was 3. So I also, like you, like identify as like 1.5 gen, you know,
yeah.
because we didn't come as adults. Right. We weren't entirely born there. And they culturally brought the culture with them, mm-hmm. you know, when we immigrated. So I have been struggling with, you know, do I call myself Chinese or Taiwanese for a very long time? People are like, oh, are you Chinese Canadian? I'm like, sure, you know, because mm-hmm. I'm sort of like Chinese Taiwanese, like, you know, yeah. like I don't know how to
and even like my parents' generation, like because of martial law, they've grown up under an education system that told them like you are Chinese,
right? That's exactly ethnic.
Yeah,
you're ethnically Chinese. Taiwan's just a province, right? Because like
right
for so long the government essentially just said, well, we're officially a province and that part of China, it's all occupied. We're the real government, right? So like politically, we're supposedly China, right?
Yeah. And it's so confusing. And it's so interesting because my mom, my maternal grandpa was born in China, was abducted by Chiang Kai-shek's army to be a child soldier. And then that's how he was abducted into Taiwan. And my grandma is Benshenren Taiwanese. So, you know, it was kind of like, my grandpa was already so old, like, I mean, maybe in his 40s or early, like late for that age to get married. And my mom was telling me like, yeah, nobody wanted to marry those men that came from China. And so you see a lot of single old men. And what happened was they would marry like whoever they could find, right? Sometimes just whoever. But my grandma is different. Like my grandma, she's like, you know, amazing woman, beautiful woman. And that's what, and my grandpa, my mom said the only thing he had for him was his looks. So that's why my grandma, like being Taiwanese, I guess she didn't really have a choice, but they married. It ended up being a really good marriage. Mm. But my mom was considered Weissen then. And
your mom was so interesting.
Yeah. So she told me like her experiences dating where like she had boyfriends who families were Benson. They're like, don't date her. You have to break up.
Right? Like, it's like, these are like people that are living together, working together. And that was like constantly a part of the society.
Yeah. So within like your own people, there's just so much divide and so much hatred towards each other. And I wonder if it's just, and I tried to ask my parents this, but they're not like, they're not willing to talk about a lot of this stuff. I didn't even know about this until grad school when I had to create a family tree. And I asked them and I was like, oh my gosh, my grandpa was a child soldier. He was abducted. Oh, my great uncle was, you know, in prison. And they're like, so nervous. I was like, what's wrong? Like, they were just so nervous to talk about it because when they immigrated, it was still very like hush hush.
Yes.
Like they immigrated to the States in the 90s. I think it wasn't until like 1995 or something like that. The Taiwanese president first mentioned the massacre. And that's when Taiwan started to like start to recognize. Right. Yep. But then because our parents immigrated before that, they never had a chance to really talk about it and heal. So they're frozen in this trauma in the States.
100%. I feel like people who immigrated from Taiwan, because we immigrated in the 70s. And so when we immigrated, I feel like they were frozen too. Like I felt the same way because we actually moved back to Taiwan. And I think it was also even like a culture shock for them to go back.
Oh yeah.
Because everybody like, it's like, oh, like modern.
So this, progressive. That, you know,
yeah. Right. Yeah. So, and it was so different from when they had left. So I agree with you. I think that immigration brings a level of frozenness in time.
Oh, absolutely. And that's really the phenomenon that a lot of Asian Americans experience, right? Or Asian immigrants, Asian Canadians experience is this frozenness. Like they are frozen at that time capsule.
Yes.
And whatever patriarchal cultural values at that time they brought with them. So actually Asian Americans
are more conservative.
Much more conservative.
Than, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
We experienced that for sure. Like we went back to Taiwan and I think my parents were like, wait a minute, like what? Like why, you know, no, this is not good. That's so interesting. And language changes too, right? Like the language, the culture, the food, like they're just constantly progressing as a society.
Absolutely.
But the immigrants stay kind of stuck.
And then they stay within their ethnic enclaves, right? Mm. To kind of form, because that's the only type of view that they can identify and understand with. And then you think about being a child of immigrants, being raised in that very conservative time period. That's what, like maybe the 1970s, but you were, you know, like it's not the 1970s, right? In a different country too. Like that's just layers.
It's layers and layers. So I'm curious then, because when I look at your website, you're both a coach and a therapist. These modalities are very different, you know? So what made you choose doing both? Like why?
Yeah. So there's a couple of reasons. First is my personality is very like coachy. I, you know, have experienced so much healing in my life through therapy, but then like, I felt like that gives me a good baseline to build upon. And so that's where the coaching comes in, where I use what the things that people have done in therapy and healed in therapy to kind of like empower them to, okay, now that you healed from this pain, how do you turn this pain into power? Where therapy is really just helping you get to a baseline. And then like, okay, now you're good. And, you know, but coaching kind of gives you a framework to be like, okay, now what? This is what you can do. This is how you thrive. So it's very much my personality. Another reason is coaching is less stigmatized than therapy, right? Mm. And my population that I work with are Asians. And how therapy is so stigmatized in the Asian community because of
Oh, totally. Yeah. Like, Xingli Yi Sen, like, why would you do that? Like, what's wrong with you? Right. Like, it's not something that they believe in. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's this blame too, if you, or you must be weak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Oh, like, yeah.
Just forget about it. Just don't think that way.
Right. Yeah. Don't think about it. You know, we don't care that it's actually stuck in trauma, in your nervous system. Just don't think about it and don't react to it.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't think that solves any problems.
Yeah. And a lot of this messaging comes from like the older generation too, right?
Sure. Who've
experience trauma. And what trauma does to you is like, you're just trying to survive, right?
Yes.
When you don't have your basic needs, and your basic needs is like your ceiling, right? You're trying to just meet that level. You're not going to be able to have your emotional needs met.
No,
right?
Not at all.
When you think about a Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like basic needs at the bottom rung, then emotional needs, then psychological needs, and then the tip is where you self-actualize, right? And that's like where we get to be. We get to self-actualize because we've already had the privilege of having our basic needs met. Of course, not everybody does, but because of what our parents went through, they really pushed for that ceiling of getting our basic needs. So that became our floor. Because of that,
yeah,
we can move on to that next tier of getting our emotional needs met. And what's so sad is that because our parents were just striving for that basic needs, they did not move up to that next level, meaning they never had the language or ability to really articulate those things or even understand, because you're just in survival mode.
So going back to what you said about therapy, therapy could have taken people from overwhelm into survival. And then really coaching takes them from survival to thriving. When you think about the Maslow's hierarchy of need, really, had they been open to therapy or had they been able to get therapy, then they could have been moved upwards a little bit. Mm-hmm. Whereas coaching, you're kind of taking people all the way up into sort of empowerment and self-actualization.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, they couldn't, because they just knew that they wanted to make enough money to take care of everybody. They wanted to make sure that everybody got educated. They wanted to make mm-hmm. sure that people had roofs over their heads. And they just so focused mm-hmm. on that. Mm-hmm. That they didn't have yeah. any headspace for anything else.
Yeah. And it wasn't a choice.
No, it wasn't a choice. I agree. Yeah.
And with that, trauma does something to you. It changes the way your brain works. It makes you not be able to hold nuance, right? You have to have very black and white thinking, very binary thinking.
Very rigid. Yeah.
Rigid, right? Because rigidity means control. Right?
Yeah.
When you can control your environment, that's when it's safe. That's what they're striving for. They're striving for safety, because what they've experienced in trauma was unsafety.
And so it's so hard, because now they're in a Western environment where their children go to school and come up with all of these Western ideas of, I need consent, or I need to be individual, or I need to have my own opinion. And it's like, wait a minute, you having your own opinion is not safe for me as a parent. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. So it's really like shaking their whole worldview.
Completely.
Everything that they've built their identity upon is being challenged.
And so you having this lived experience and working with your clients and, you know, having both the modality of coaching and therapy, I'm curious about your program. You have something called Client Love Take Up Space Group Coaching. Mm-hmm. And I'm wanting to hear from you why this is so important and why it's unique for Asian Americans.
Yeah. So Take Up Space is really a group program for us to really unpack and deconstruct our Asian American identity and experience. I decided to start this group because I've always wanted a space like this for myself. I always complain, like, why is there a space where I can like learn about Asian American stuff beyond like grad school or what, I don't want to necessarily major in this, or not everybody has the opportunity to go to grad school or college or what have you. And it wasn't really until like in academia, that's when I had the opportunity to do those things. But I've always wanted just like a mentor or somebody to give me language for what I was experiencing, because I felt like because I wasn't able to experience it, it was so much easier to minimize and just dismiss whatever I was experiencing.
100%.
Right.
Well, nobody else understood.
Yeah.
Like, literally nobody else understood.
Yeah, because we're seen as this invisible minority, right? And then if we can't express it ourselves, then we're invisible to ourselves.
100%. Yes.
Yeah. But I've experienced so much pain of being invisible, and especially with the rise of anti-Asian hate crimes, like because of the work that I did, I was able to connect that, like, you know, these hate crimes are fueled by these stereotypes that Asians have. And a lot of Asians haven't had, because they haven't had the opportunity to really understand structural racism or colonial mindsets or whatever, they really live into this model minority myth.
Absolutely.
Perpetuate these stereotypes.
All Chinese people are good at math. And it's like, well, not all.
Yeah.
You know, and oh, you have to get into business, engineering, accounting, or be a doctor. Like it's a very rigid, limited view of success.
And when you think about like the immigrants too, like they're not really learning Asian American history because they don't see themselves as Asian Americans. They still see themselves as like foreigners, right? So
you know what's funny though? It's because I don't know about your groups of people, but like we often say Waiguren, foreigners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When we meet anybody who's not
Asian
or
Chinese.
Yeah. You're like, oh, they're foreigners, even though I'm walking in Canada, I'm in Canada, and they're like, oh, that's a Waiguren. And it's like, no, you're the Waiguren.
Right? Yeah.
You're the foreigner.
I like that reframe because to them, they're the center.
Yes.
You know, rather than say like feeling like, oh, I'm the perpetual foreigners. I feel like the second gen is more like, oh, we feel like foreigners. Yeah,
because we look at like the second gen is like, even though I'm born here, even though I feel like this is my culture, I will always look foreign. Right. Like that's what the younger generation would feel.
But to our parents' generation, it's like flipped, which I think it might be better for them, honestly. But yeah, so because of that, like they see everybody else as the other. They're not going to go and learn the other people's history like whatever.
No.
Right. So they don't understand the stereotypes that they're living into either.
Yes.
Which
agreed.
Then causes, I think it. That because when we live into these narratives that subjugate us, it exposes us to being abused and exploited and hurt and hated upon.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what fuels the anti-Asian violence. And I thought that if we could just create space for people to understand these dynamics so that they can dismantle this internalized model minority, then we would be able to create our own narratives of who Asian Americans are. And then once we have a community of people who do that, who stand by that message, we can have more representation of Asian stories and thus change the dominant narrative of who Asians are. So that's the mission.
And so with this group coaching program, people are learning it organically and together. Like, so you're bringing things that you learned from grad school, or you're bringing in speakers, or what does this program look like?
Yeah. So it looks like, so we're meeting every week, about like 4 to 5 members, and we go through different topics such as like racialization, where we talk about the model minority myth or the perpetual foreigner stereotype. We talk about navigating dualities, like being part of, you know, both worlds, but not really feeling a part of them, kind of like in this limbo-ness, right? How do you navigate that? I talked to them about psychological concepts too, about like acculturation stress. We talk about, the idea of liminality versus marginality. So just a lot of these different concepts that people are like, they never really understood and still don't really, it's not like talked about often unless like in academia. So I bring in like different topics each week and we go through a curriculum reprocess.
That is amazing. That's something that I wish I had when I was younger, for sure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm thinking about these topics because when you say, oh, you know, you don't feel like you're, you know, in either culture. And I spent a lot of my life, it depended on how I was mentally, because if I'm mentally well, I could sort of fit in both. you know. But when I'm not mentally well, I absolutely felt like I didn't fit anywhere. Like there isn't a single place that truly embraced me holistically, and at all parts of me and all different cultures of me. So
yeah, we kind of float through these different spheres of belonging and unbelonging, and like there's so rarely spaces where we can fully belong, right? Yeah. But I really believe it's like finding other kindred spirits who identify as being in the middle to create those spaces of belonging.
Yes, I agree. Well, I went to an international school in Taiwan, and my friends are all third culture, or what we would call third culture, kids. Yeah. So we had white friends who grew up in Asia for so long that they were actually more Asian than they were American. Mm-hmm. You know, we had friends from India, from South Africa, from Finland, and we all experienced being in Taiwan. So there were moments of time where there was a feeling of belonging with others who were all different. And when I was an expat in Hong Kong, it did feel like there was a feeling of belonging with expats, like people from around the world, but these are such transient populations. You come and go and you move around, and everybody kind of moves around all over the world, you know? So you might feel a sense of belonging for a year until everybody moves.
And that's really that idea of liminality, where, you know, you're not belonging really in either space, because belonging is actually a construct. Right. It's the understanding that belonging is a paradigm and you don't fit into those boxes. And when you are free from boxes, then you can belong everywhere.
Everywhere and anywhere. That's so beautiful. I think that the people, your participants of this group, must just absolutely love this program.
And I hope.
And I hope that, you know, lots of people consider taking it, and they could look this up on your website, I believe. So hopefully people who, you know, identify this way and want to do more work on this, can come to you, myself included. So as we come to the end of this amazing interview, which I could like talk to you for hours, by the way, so interesting. My last question for you, you know, you're a family therapist, you're an empowerment coach. If you could give one piece of advice to parents who may have their own trauma, but they're now trying to raise responsible, resilient adults of the future, what would that advice be?
Oh man, it's so hard to just, I'm like trying to find the root of the advice that I can give you, but it's really to recognize that your healing is going to translate to your parenting and your relationship with your children. So often we try to reach out externally and we try to mold them when we ourselves are still hurt and empty and broken, right? And it feels selfish to put ourselves first, but actually when you break those cycles for yourself, right, that's going to translate into the next generation. And when you can speak kindness to yourself, when you can speak love to yourself, like you're modeling that for your own children. Actually, the way that you may nitpick at your kids or whatever is how you criticize yourself, but you probably do it 10 times worse, right? When you can speak truth and kindness to yourself, that will translate to how they can be kind to themselves. It gives them permission to love themselves. Oh,
I just had to sit with that because I 100% agree with that as part of my own healing journey and as part of what I do say to my coaching clients. 100%. I do think that that's the core. I really do think that's the core. I think you've hit the nail on the head. So listen, Angela, you're so amazing. Thank you for what you do. You know, you're making the world a better place. And I really appreciate the time that you spent with me and our listeners.
Thank you so much, Sherry, for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to the Sandwich Parenting Podcast. I hope, like me, you've learned something new that will help you along with your parenting journey. If you wish, you can always connect with me at www.sandwichparenting.com.